This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It's April 15th, 2013. They're scattered around the city in the aftermath of a bombing at the Boston Marathon, counseling the traumatized, helping families get updates on their missing loved ones, providing support to those charged with making big decisions. Dozens of chaplains helping those in need. Chaplains like Reverend Julia Dunbar, Director of Pastoral Care at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. And just a warning, this sound may bring back painful memories for some. Listen with care.
I've been asking people, how are you? And people are asking me, how are you? And how do you answer that? When do we cry? It hasn't really fully hit me yet. Sometimes things like this hit you when you are doing the most unexpected thing, you know, when you're carrying your groceries in and suddenly the bag breaks and the oranges spill all over the floor and you sit down and cry.
Reverend Dunbar spoke with WBUR's Sasha Pfeiffer just after the bombings in 2013. And then chaplains in the news again. It's 2020 because of their role during the start of the COVID-19 pandemic. The New York Times described them as, quote, those who ran toward the dying, end quote. And their role among us is growing in an increasingly secularized society. Wendy Kadge of Brandeis University has been studying chaplains and their work for almost two decades. Part of that research is included in her new book, Spiritual Care, The Everyday Work of Chaplains. Wendy Kadge joins us now. Wendy, welcome to Studio 2.
Good to be here.
So let's start with the simple definition. What exactly is a chaplain?
It's a great question, unfortunately, without a simple answer. I describe chaplains as religious professionals that work outside of congregations, mostly in public settings like the military, healthcare, higher education, prisons, and other settings.
So religious professionals, but not necessarily members of the cloth.
Correct.
And what are the most common misconceptions about chaplains other than, and we know that one is, person of the cloth?
Many people think chaplains are all Christian. Not true. Chaplains in the United States today are as diverse as all the rest of us. Some people think chaplains proselytize and are there to convince people of their own religious beliefs. Also not true. Chaplains are there to create the space to help people be in the midst of difficult events and to help them find their way, whatever that way may be.
So when I was reading your book, Spiritual Care, The Everyday Work of Chaplains, I picked up, Wendy, a tremendous sense of urgency from you that people understand this is a group of people that exists. They're out there right now. They're doing incredibly challenging work, and they've been doing it for more than 100 years. Where did that urgency come from for you?
I think there's a few places. First, we have results from a Gallup survey that we conducted at Brandeis University in 2022 that suggests about a quarter of Americans have had contact with a chaplain. So chaplains are out there.
So one in four people. Sorry, go ahead.
Chaplains are out there, but they're in the shadows. They're in the interstices. They're doing quiet work at the edges. And I worry that because, at least before the pandemic, they're not often in public view or in the spotlight, people both don't think to reach to them if they could be of support, but they also don't think about the incredibly important role they play in American religious leadership and in the care that I think so many of us desperately need in these days.
And I noticed that in these days, which is a piece of the book. I mean, so you note the first chaplain you talk about is actually the Boston Fire Department, 1906, leave it to Boston, be the center of everything, right? But you're now, you talk about that fanning out, including here in Boston over the last, let's say, 120 years, mm-hmm. into lots of corners where people need, where people grieve, where people experience trauma.
Yes. And part of what I think is happening is that traditional congregations, particularly since the pandemic, are closing or not reopening. There's a story that's growing about the secularization of American religious life. Yes, and. So this, you know, one-third or more of people, especially under the age of 30, who are not religiously affiliated, are not necessarily secular. And so part of my urgency comes from really believing that religious professionals have unique and important messages to bring and ways to support individuals, but worrying that as people tell stories about secularization, the new, the different, the hidden ways that chaplains are present and supporting people from the marathon bombing to Boston Healthcare for the Homeless to in, you know, facilities caring for people at the edges of society are overlooked, forgotten, or maybe have never been seen.
We're speaking with Wendy Kadge, who's a professor at Brandeis University, about The hidden chaplains who actually affect the lives, according to a poll, of about 1 in 4 Americans. I want to add a chaplain voice to our conversation now. And I know you know Stephen Cushing, who's director and chaplain with the New England Seafarers Mission. He's also featured in your book. Stephen, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
So, Stephen, give me a moment, either in your day today or in your day yesterday, when you knew you were acting as a chaplain.
Wow, that's a really good question. Day today or a day yesterday? Can I go back a couple of days?
Is that all right? Yes, you can.
Went on board an industrial ship. First of all, that's what I do, is I visit industrial ships in the Port of Boston, and we run a cruise center for seafarers on cruise ships. And yesterday, or a few days ago, I was on an industrial ship and was speaking with some crew members, and they wanted to get a SIM card so that they could activate their phone and call home and speak with their families in India. I knew that there was some technical difficulties there, and I tried to give them all sorts of transparency that it might not work, so forth. The chief officer came, and he said to his crew, listen, I've been dealing with chaplains for 10 or 15 years. They've never lied to me, and I don't think he's going to start lying now, so listen to what he says. He's here to help you. And that, to me, kind of just summed it up, is that from the word of this guy who has experience, he was able to share that with his crew and bring the stamp of approval, a stamp of honesty to a guy that these people have never seen before and will probably never, ever see again. But in one instant moment, they trusted me because of the previous activity of this chief officer on the ship.
I can hear in your voice that that meant a lot to you.
It really did. That's the moment that I love and live for in my ministry, is that moment when I make that connection and the crew member is reconnected with his family, with society, with his culture, with something. He just needs to reconnect with something so he doesn't feel like he's still out in the middle of the ocean.
Wendy, we're talking about service here, true service.
And service that we can hear in Steve's voice is available to everyone. You know, the seafarers that Steve was interacting with certainly knew that he was a chaplain. But where he came from, what his own religious background was in some ways not relevant because he was serving all.
And is that how you see it, Steve?
Yes, actually it is. Two of those seafarers were of Hindu faith. I simply said, as I was leaving, I said, may God bless you and keep you safe. They deeply, deeply appreciated that. They probably and did have very different beliefs from me, but I tried to make that touch again, that connection that you're not alone in this world. And when I leave, you're still not alone. There is somebody watching over you.
So we have more time to talk coming up. Before we take a quick pause in our conversation, though, I want to ask you, Stephen, why people on ships?
Well, seafarers, the standard answer is this. The seafarers are in an industry that supplies the world with what it needs to keep going. And our famous phrase is, everything that you and I use, 90% of it at one point was on a ship. So if ships stopped sailing, our global economy, our world would essentially shut down. They are sacrificing family, culture, and even risking their lives for this job and to bring products to the rest of the world. They are also, and I've met 167 nationalities doing this, they are the stranger from another country knocking on our door. That's why.
We are having a conversation about chaplains in the greater Boston community, a hidden, often, or invisible resource of accompaniment during times of trauma or need or confusion. Still with us, Stephen Cushing, director and chaplain with the New England Seafarers Mission, and Wendy Kadge, author of the new book, Spiritual Care, The Everyday Work of Chaplains. And I understand, Wendy, you've got a book event at 5 today at the BU School of Theology. Is that right?
Correct.
Excellent. So listen, I want to talk now about religion. And Stephen, I'll start with you. One of the things that really struck me in reading Wendy's book was the intersection, but not complete overlap. So you can't see me, Stephen, but I've got two circles, and they're overlapping by Venn diagram, right? Between faith traditions and people of the cloth and chaplains. And it's not a complete one-to-one, if that makes sense, is it?
No, it really isn't. I like what Dr. Kadge said. We're serving a group of people who, though they may not have a church or mosque or temple, or faith community, they are nonetheless still searching, still looking, and they need someone to know that they are not forgotten. And that is what, in my mind, God is all about, finding the lost and letting them know that they are remembered and they are loved by Him. That's the connection.
So, Wendy Kadge, I'll turn back to you. I want to remind people that you told us earlier in this conversation that roughly one in four people in America have their lives touched by a chaplain, whether it's at a university or it's at a hospital or it's as part of a service industry, et cetera. I want to play a little sound. So the head of the chaplain group at Harvard University is a guy named Greg Epstein, who's actually a humanist. And here's a little sound of him speaking with Michel Martin at NPR last April.
Non-religious people like me, atheists, agnostics, humanists, secular people, however you want to call us, we are allies for and of progressive and moderate religious people in the United States and across the world. Those are my friends and allies, and I'll fight with them to the death. And that's what you see in this kind of interfaith cooperation.
So we'll come back in a minute to the mission part of what he's talking about, Wendy. But for now, I want to zero in on those words. You know, atheist, agnostic, humanist, secular. Have we evolved in who chaplains are as the country has evolved into an increasingly secular role? And how do you do the pastoral across religions? Does that make sense?
Yep, that does make sense. So there are growing numbers of humanist chaplains, particularly in higher education. There are other settings like the military that aren't quite ready to welcome humanist chaplains in their ranks. I think really more important than the categories of the chaplains is the conversations they're having about death, about transition, about decision-making in difficult points. And well-trained professional chaplains talk about the issues. They certainly don't talk about themselves. And honestly, whether they're humanist or Christian or Jewish or Muslim is much less important than the space that they are able to create to have conversations about real issues, real existential and sometimes joyful and more often challenging issues in people's lives.
Because pain doesn't discriminate based on your faith tradition or the moment you're in. When you need support, you need support.
Correct. And that we all struggle with these big picture questions about life and death and meaning and purpose and transition. And that's what the work of chaplaincy is most of the time. We've actually done quite a few interviews recently with people who have engaged with chaplains. And while some have talked about particular religious rituals or things that are unique to one religious tradition, more often they're talking about general conversation. Some call it pastoral, although that word has a Christian undertone. I would think about it as more spiritual or existential support. About the things in life that are hard. And as Steve has said, that people are not alone in them. And that accompaniment, that presence, that conversation, that being in the midst of difficulty and bearing witness to where people are is what the work of chaplains is.
Stephen Cushing of the New England Seafarers Mission, I'm struck by this word accompaniment. I think we've all had times in our lives where we feel lost, whether we're losing somebody close to us to death or we're confused in a moment of trauma, something bad has happened and we feel a little unmoored. Can you tell me a story of your accompanying somebody and how you did that, what resources you drew on for yourself to do that?
Sure. I think we've all learned over these last 2 years with the pandemic a little bit more about what loneliness is, what it is to be alone, to be cut off. It's not a natural human place to be. Several years ago, we had a crew member working on the pier, and he was seriously hurt. He was from the Philippines, and he required 4 or 5 months in Boston hospitals and about 6 operations to repair his damaged foot. And so 2 or 3 times a week, my wife Sharon and I would go to visit him and whatever hospital he was in and walk alongside of him. His wife finally came here to be with him from the Philippines. It was a long, long, long journey. And finally, at the very end, he finally got permission to fly home, and he was so excited. But he needed to get all the medical records from all 4 hospitals on a Friday afternoon before he flew out Saturday. I said, that's impossible. And he wouldn't have it. He said, if you'll drive me, I'll get them. We drove around all of Boston for an afternoon, found all of his medical records. I was astounded. He had everything he needed to go home. And once again, he turned to me and said, I will never, ever forget you and your wife. Thank you, Father, for what you have done.
Have you ever heard from him again?
Oh, yeah. He's on Facebook. I do hear from him. I see his birthdays and his wife's birthday. It is he's not working at sea anymore because the damage was too great for his injury. But I do keep track of him. And it's a blessing to see that for the moment that he was here in Boston for those few months, we accompanied him along that part of the journey.
Wendy, I wish people could see the grin on your face. It is ear to ear.
And there are so many stories like this. Steve, as you were talking, I was thinking about my colleague, Trace Haythorne, who's the executive director of the Association for Clinical Pastoral Education, ACPE. And he tells a story about when he was a young pediatric chaplain. He was caring for a patient and a family. The child unfortunately died, and they asked him to do the service because they really didn't have anyone to reach out to. He did the service, and now 20 or 30 years later, he's recently been contacted by that family, who he has not heard from in 20 to 30 years, and they told him that they listened to the service that he did every year to mark and honor their child's memory.
Isn't that touching? And I don't mean that in a glib way. I mean that that touches you at its core because it shows you how important it was to that family. So, Stephen, all right. So over the years, as we've evolved, chaplaincies in, I learned this from Wendy's book, in firefighting and policing, in hospitals, increasingly in social service organizations. Wendy, you mentioned Boston Healthcare for the Homeless, chaplaincy there. What's the new front, Stephen? Where will we see chaplains 5 years from now that we might not be expecting?
I think, well, from my point of view, and remember what I'm a chaplain of, industrial ships. From my point of view, I think we'll see more industrial business chaplains, if you will. If the world is becoming increasingly secularized, and I take that word to mean they're simply stopped looking for organized religion in organized places, but they're not, they haven't stopped their journey. And so it will be even more important for chaplains to be at these places to accompany them along whatever journey it is they're trying to find. I leave it in the hands of the Almighty to figure out how the revelation of who that Almighty is going to be revealed. In my Christian faith, I believe that has happened. I'm praying that they come along and they find that journey, they find that path, and that ultimately in all of these places where organized religion typically hasn't been, place of business and of commercial and waterfront, you name it, that's where you'll find a need for chaplains to continue that journey and walk with them along that special path.
And Wendy, we have 30 seconds left. Where do you see chaplains next?
I think we need to ask where the demand is. And the demand is in veterinary hospitals and emergencies. It's with people who are unhoused. It's in community settings. It's amongst a diversity of people. And I just want to invite people to join us in the Chaplaincy Innovation Lab because we don't have the business models yet to support the chaplains where they are needed. And we're trying together as a community and a collaboration to figure that out. And so there's a lot of demand and a lot of possibility. And we're going to get there if we're all able to work together.
All right. Wendy Kadge is Brandeis University sociology professor and author of Spiritual Care, The Everyday Work of Chaplains, and Stephen Cushing is director and chaplain with the New England Seafarers Mission, also in the book. Wendy, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And Stephen, thank you to you too.
Been my pleasure. Thank you.
Not going to lie, I always wonder what runs through people's heads when they hear that. For me, it's just this tingle of joy and magic, and it is Nutcracker season. And for a different take on Tchaikovsky's classic ballet, we are speaking about The Extraordinary Nutcracker, produced by the United Dance Company. It is an inclusive dance company that, in the words of founder Boris Richet, quote, offers high-quality, tailor-made dance courses for youth and young adults who have Down syndrome both in Europe and the States, end quote. Boris Richet is here, founder and artistic director of the United Dance Company. Welcome to Studio 2.
Hi, thank you.
Great to have you also here in Studio 2, Faye Jones, who plays Clara, dances the role of Clara, the lead role in the United Dance Company, along with mom Tracy Jones. Faye, welcome.
Thank you.
And Tracy, welcome to you.
Thank you very much for having us.
Faye, how long have you been dancing?
Altogether, I've been dancing for 20 years.
And in those 20 years, did you dream of dancing the Nutcracker?
Actually, yes, I have.
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of the one everybody wants to dance, right?
Yes.
And Tracy, what does it mean to you as a mom who's got a dancer to see them tell this story? I know it's a, Boris, we're going to talk in a second about this take on this story, but this is one of the great Christmas classics, Tracy.
Oh, absolutely. You know, we used to go regularly when Faye was younger to see the Nutcracker, you know, done by the Boston Ballet Corps, and it was always very exciting. But to actually have a performer in it is, you know, yeah, it's hard to put into words.
So, Boris, you trained at the Paris Opera Ballet School. You danced professionally with the Semperoper Ballet in Dresden, Germany, for the Boston Ballet, the Atlanta Ballet, and then comes United Dance Company in 2018. What had you pivot to creating this kind of dance and these kinds of opportunities?
So while I was dancing at Boston Ballet, I discovered their adaptive dance program, which has been going on for about over 20 years now. I thought it was amazing. And I looked at my own country, Belgium. We didn't have anything like it. So I figured, let's start. Let's do a one-week course, which we did. And then it snowballed into what United Dance is today, with locations across Europe, across the States. And then last year, Jenny DiMarco, who is a local choreographer to Boston, who actually co-founded the Boston Ballet Adaptive Dance Program, approached United Dance and said, listen, what do you think about starting a company within United Dance? And that's how the United Dance Company started.
So, Faye, do you remember, I'm trying to think if there's anything I can remember from 20 years ago, but
okay.
Do you remember your first dance classes 20 years ago?
It was fun with my favorite teacher, Gino. And
your favorite teacher was Gino?
Yes.
What did you like about Gino?
He's more friendly
mm-hmm.
and more interactive.
And when you started to learn to dance, did you find yourself thinking, I am good at this. This is something I can really do.
Yes, definitely.
Tracy, what does that mean for you as a mom?
It was definitely an outlet for her, for sure. I mean, she does a lot of other things, but dance is just where she's at. She feels the music, she internalizes it. And to have the opportunity to dance with somebody like Gino and with Boris and the company, it's a big deal, yeah.
Have you danced?
No, not really.
Does it make you now watching Faye dance, right, and be in a production like a Nutcracker story, does it make you make your toes move a little bit and your arms move like you'd like to dance too?
Oh, for sure. Yeah. I mean, I did tap dance when I was very little.
So a little bit. So you've done a little bit.
I'm kind of musical. But yes, it does make you want to get out there on stage. It's fun.
So,
but I'm sure I wouldn't do it to the same extent.
Boris, tell us about Gino and the other teachers. What do they bring to these classes and to a production like Extraordinary Nutcracker?
So Jenny DiMarco is the choreographer of the Extraordinary Nutcracker.
Mm-hmm.
With United Dance, our goal is to be able to give the highest possible level of dance education for our courses and just the highest possible artistic level for the company. I've been fortunate enough to work for beautiful dance companies, and that is what I want to bring to United Dance, that
so here,
same level.
Here's a little bit of sound of you during the pandemic giving a class on YouTube.
And breathe in. And breathe out. And we become very small, very small, very small, very small. And very big, very big, very big, very big, everyone, very big, stretch out your toes, and very small, very small, very small, very small, very small, and very big, very big, very big, very big, everyone, even bigger, even bigger, even bigger, good job, and feet on the ground. Lower your arms.
Everything I could do in Studio 2 not to be stretching my arms out and making very, 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 very small and then stretching out again. Those are meditative skills. Those are learning your body and your physicality skills. This is more than just dance, isn't it?
Yes,
and
it is.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to be dismissive about dance at all. I have tremendous respect. I just mean it's even more than dance.
So we've discovered that especially for youth and young adults with Down syndrome, dance is an amazing way to develop so many skills, both mental and physical skills. So you will work on core strength, you will work on leadership skills, you will work on gaining some confidence, and at the same time to know that, hey, maybe now I need to take a little step back and let someone else dance. And we do all of this in a very fun and joyful environment. I think dance has given me a lot of things, and that's what I'm looking to give to our students now. So,
In a minute, I want to dive into the performance, Extraordinary Nutcracker. But before we do, one of the things that's been on my mind, Boris, is it accessible to everyone? How are you funded? Is it expensive? Can all families who might want this opportunity for their child or sibling access it?
Of course. So we have a very robust scholarship program. So our courses are priced, you know, at the price that they are. We offer a very high quality experience. However, we have never had anyone be unable to participate because of financial reasons.
And you have foundations that fund you? Is that how it works?
Yes, so we're all privately funded, private foundations. So I know you're doing your own fundraising.
It is
towards the end of the year, but uniteddance.org/donate. If anyone is interested, any donations are more than welcome. Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about The Extraordinary Nutcracker now, which is produced. We're speaking here with Boris Richer, who's the founder and artistic director of the United Dance Company, and Faye Jones, who's a dancer playing Clara in this production, along with Tracy Jones, who's Faye's mother. So here's a little bit of sound. This is from Act 1, Scene 1 of the show. And Faye, I'm going to play a little sound for you, and then I'm going to ask you about it.
Okay, then.
My dearest grandchild, my beautiful Clara, I am sitting here in my family's ancestral home, looking back on my life and thinking of yours ahead. You are turning 16 today, and seeing you grow up fills me with the greatest joy.
Who is Clara?
Well, the young girl who is actually turning 16 and is having a fabulous time dancing.
And her grandmother, as I understand it, wants to share a story. Here's a little more sound from the prologue.
For your birthday, I will tell you the story of my greatest adventure when I myself was only 16. I have kept the story a secret until now. It's a thrilling tale, and I hope it inspires you to go have adventures of your own. Let me start at the beginning, so many years ago. I was so excited for my 16th birthday.
Tracy, that makes me think of my grandmother and my mother, both of whom are passed. How does it feel as a mom to have your daughter dancing as Clara in this story of women handing down an incredible story of adventure over the generations?
Well, as you say, it makes me think of my own grandmother and mother, who also sadly both passed. But yeah, it's very exciting. I haven't seen the rehearsals, actually, you know, any of the performances so far.
Oh, you
so
haven't I'm gotten excited. To see any of it
no,
yet.
No, I haven't, because I want to be surprised on the day. So I've been to, you know, sitting outside the studios while the rehearsals have been going on, but I'm excited to see the show.
That would drive me crazy, not knowing what it's going to look like. Have you seen the costumes?
No.
Oh,
no.
My gosh.
Well, and that's not true. I have seen Faye's costume, because it's a costume that has been used in prior show, but... And I've seen the mouse heads.
So, Boris, why this version? Why tell this version of this story? It's kind of an origin story of the Nutcracker.
Yes, it is.
Will.
Yes, it is. So Faye is actually dancing Claire. Mm-hmm. And the voice that you just heard is Faye as an adult writing down a letter.
Oh, so she's the grandmother.
So, exactly.
Oh, you can tell I haven't seen it yet either, because it hasn't premiered.
And so our adult Claire writes a letter to Clara, who mm-hmm. we all know from The Usual Nutcracker.
Right.
Our story happens before that, because we all know of the Nutcracker, we all know of Clara, we all know of the mice, and so on. But how did this Nutcracker come to be? And that is the story that we'll be telling in The Extraordinary Nutcracker. So adult Claire writes a letter to her granddaughter, Clara, on this great adventure that she had. And this is what you get to see. And Faye is Claire in that adventure.
Faye, without giving too much away, what's your favorite moment in the story?
Well, the ending, definitely. But also showcasing my ability.
Showcasing your ability to dance. Yeah. Do you feel like you're going to continue to dance for another 20 years?
Yes. I really want to keep going dancing.
And I understand sometimes you help teach.
Yes, I do.
And what does that mean to you, to now be able to help other young people learn to dance?
Good. I've been helping out with other teachers and seeing them. Sorry.
It's okay. I can tell this means a lot to you. I appreciate you sharing it with us.
Yes.
Do you want to take a break for a sec? Why don't you take a break for a sec?
Yes, please.
Yeah, that sounds great. So, Tracy, clearly so meaningful for Faye.
Right, she does get very emotional, yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
So do I when I'm talking about things that mean a lot to me. So let's turn to you and Boris now. The opportunity to see Faye do something that means so much to her. That's the work, Boris, yes?
Yes, no, exactly. But on top of that, just from an audience perspective, we're talking about amazing artists, first and foremost. So you're not going to go see a company with dancers that have Down syndrome. You're going to see an amazing company with dancers of amazing artistic ability.
And Tracy, what do you want people to know going into the production?
Yeah, exactly. But I would echo what Boris said. You're going to see a show with amazing performers. The fact that they have Down syndrome is neither here nor there. It's, you know, and a lot of people refer to it as a disability. I call it a special ability.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and yeah, set that aside. It has nothing to do with it. And go in with an open mind. Just see, you know, enjoy the show.
Faye, thank you for being here and for sharing something that's so important to you. I really appreciate it. Tracy Jones, thanks to you too.
You're
and
welcome.
Boris Rashier, founder and artistic director of the United Dance Company. Thanks to you as well. That is our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thank you for joining us in these stories. And join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.